The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Variety of things, how they work, what they are, how to relate to them. So I want to talk a little bit about that and use this as an occasion to provide a little bit of background for the meditation instructions that we have here at IMC or in the Insight Meditation movement that we're part of. And in thinking about meditation instructions, I think of them as treasures. And I use that carefully with the idea that they're something that's precious and valuable and to be valued to a great degree. They are, can be powerful tools for healing and for personal growth, for liberation, for understanding, for finding a way to live in this life, difficult life that we have, in a way that is peaceful, kind, loving, compassionate, all kinds of things that come from the instructions. And they come to us handed down from, to some degree, from one person to another. Even if you've learned them first in a book, it's from someone who wrote the book, and that person learned it maybe from a teacher, maybe firsthand or secondhand, or you know, and goes back generations, and so they little bit represent that way the cumulative wisdom of many people, of the things that worked for them, the things that they worked for their students as they taught them, and going back perhaps to the Buddha. The Buddha had gave instructions in meditation. Their surviving records talk about those instructions, and they're quite brilliant, I think, but they're also kind of an outline form, and they require, for the most part, some kind of filling in with detail, with applications, with how to relate to them. And for some people, that's the role of teachers, is to kind of fill in the picture. And this is how you can do these teachings and practices. I find it fascinating that in the modern world, people will take these ancient teachings of the Buddha, instructions they have, and interpret them in wildly different ways, or apply them in different ways. And you have a whole series of different ways in which they're taught, and especially in Asia, teachers there will say, well, this is what the Buddha taught, not necessarily realizing that, you know, they were kind of a modern adaptation or a recent adaptation. I'd like to think that the meditation instructions we hear or read about or receive are partly cultural constructs. They are somehow adaptations and variations that are designed to meet particular needs of particular culture, cultural view, and also the particular circumstances of individuals. And I say that so we don't think that the meditation instructions that you receive from anyone are the pristine, perfect, ultimate teaching that comes directly from the Buddha's mouth or some other place, and this is, you know, these are the thing. They vary quite a bit and they change. And I've watched in the some 45 years now that the Insight Meditation movement has been teaching here in the West. There have been trends in those teachings, and they've changed over these decades of how they taught it. And to give you some kind of, you know, very brushstroke, broad brushstroke kind of sense of the trends over the decades, was there was a time when the teachings had a kind of Taoist flavor to them and were influenced by the teachings of Krishnamurti. And then there was a time when they were influenced by a teaching of Upandita, where there was great, impeccable precision in doing the instructions. And then came a period of time where some of the primary teachers were influenced by Advaita Vedanta and kind of a non-dual teachings. And rather than being precise and technique, it became kind of very broad and spacious and empty and non-dual kind of. And then there came influence from the Tibetan practice of Dzogchen, and also tremendous emphasis on relaxation and being open mind and the nature of awareness, and more interested in the nature of what it's like to be aware rather than the precision of what we're aware of. You don't have to remember any of this, but just I just want to give you a sense of, you know, that these things change. And then there was all the teachers who studied with the precision master, the Upandita, very technique-focused, very precise, I think every single one of them I knew, sooner or later, found themselves in a tradition, a meditation teacher, who taught people to relax. to say it simplistically, taught them how to have much more of a spacious, open awareness. And then Krishna, from Krishnamurti, we learned this concept of choiceless awareness. And then from some of these more recent teachers, then it became something more like open awareness. And then because this relaxed mode was, you know, has its own strengths and weaknesses, around the same time or soon after in the wake of that, there came a trend of a concentration practice was brought in and became a kind of emphasis or developing concentration. And some teachers themselves went off to study with some of the great concentration teachers in Asia and came back and taught, you know, concentration, real concentration, deep absorption. And so that was a trend for a while. And that was very different from the trend in the 1970s and 1980s, where it was really explicit that we don't do concentration practice. And people would come to teachers and say they're doing jhana practice, and they would say, don't do that. Sometimes they'd even say, it's dangerous, don't do that. And then slowly, in about mid-1990s and growing then for the next 10 years, came much deeper appreciation of the role and place of a deep absorption practice and jhana practice. And so that started to have a place in the practice itself. And so it keeps going on. And it'll keep going on. The trends will come. And if you step into the tradition at any one point in all those developments, teachers like me or people generally kind of say, this is it. You know, this is what we do, and then not confess that actually, you know, it's it now, but it's been changing. And I like to think that all the changes have to do with becoming wiser, more understanding, and certainly I think our tradition has become a lot wiser over these decades to understand the wide range of ways of practicing, what's appropriate for different people, different uses of developing meditation states in different circumstances, in different ways. And so there's really a wealth of knowledge that's been cultivated and developed over these 40 years that might have been there in Asia for the people who practiced in Asia, but that in Asia they tended to be much more, meditation teachers tended to be a little bit like independent operators much more, or they tended to be kind of isolated traditions. That, this is what we do and we don't do other things. And it was a real innovation for people like Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein to make a very conscious decision when they started teaching in the 1970s, and they had the center in the East Coast called the Insight Meditation Society. They made a very conscious decision to be ecumenical, to be inclusive of many different forms of meditation practice, many different styles of teaching, many different approaches, without prioritizing one particular Buddhist teaching, one tradition, one lineage, one style of practice as being the truth. And which is a little bit how they experienced it in some of the teachers in Asia. And they were kind of reacting against this kind of fundamentalism sometimes existed. This is the truth. And so they became very inclusive and they included many different teachers, voices, ways. And you do different retreats, and there were some, you know, they had these different teachings. They invited different teachers to come. And so it made it very rich. And what it did over time was help this tradition become quite knowledgeable and wise about different ways of practicing, different kinds of instructions, different ways of doing it. And then the teachers could adapt the instructions for different circumstances, different individuals who have different needs. There is a kind of a... They're developed over the early 20 years or so, a relatively standardized instructions for the insight meditation movement that became kind of like a standard that was pretty much taught regularly at retreats probably until about 10 years ago and or so. And it's still kind of there in the background or in the foreground that's taught. But when I was first teaching a lot in this tradition in the 1990s, all the teachers knew the standard instructions. And if you went to a 10-day retreat or 7-day retreat, and you know you're a teacher and you're brought in on the day 3 or day 4 or something, and they say, okay, it's day 3 of the retreat, you give the instructions today. You know, they would just give the instructions. It was kind of seamless. Everyone had little variations, personal variation, but they knew exactly where to fit in. They knew what the instructions were, and it was relatively standard. I remember getting one note at a retreat, big retreat, and someone I guess had experienced these instructions over some time, said that the insight meditation is to meditation what Campbell soup is to soup. You know, it's all packaged nicely and neat, and so I thought it was a kind of curious note to get at the retreat, and to some degree it's true, but. I thought it was actually quite brilliant, the instructions that came to, because it was a little bit broad strokes, it was relatively simple and clear, and it turned out to be kind of a middle ground or middle way, maybe a central way, that kind from which, like a hub, from which it was easy to adapt the teachings for different people in different ways. And so it was kind of like you're given, you teach someone how to pedal a bicycle and balance on the bicycle, that's good. And then later, depending on the hill you're going up or down or whatever, then you learn which gear to use and use different gears. But first you learn, you know, how to coast or, you know, on the bike or something like that. So there's this very basic teaching that's given that then it's easy to move in different directions. So some people who need more concentration, the same instructions can be kind of modified slightly to encourage people to get more concentrated. People who are getting tense and stressed out in how they're doing, you just nudge them a little bit in the other direction. You know, relax and open up and just kind of don't try so hard. And the instructions works in both directions. For some people, that instructions works well to be very directed in your practice, really focus on really seeing in some careful way what's actually happening in your experience. And then for other people, they might say, oh, don't try so hard. Just don't look so much at what's happening. Look at your relationship to what's happening. Look about how you're aware. Notice how awareness is or how awareness is being used as you're doing the practice. And so there's a constant, you know, there's all this variation, this movement, a little bit left, a little bit right, if you constantly adjusting, more effort, less effort. So I found that this instruction was quite, the standard instruction was kind of brilliant for how it was useful for a big group of people. And some of the retreats, you know, they're in the back in the 80s and 90s, and not so much anymore, maybe until a few years ago, there were some retreats that down in Yucca Valley that had 160 people. And so you kind of need to have some kind of instructions that works for a wide range of people to be able to handle that. If you're one-on-one with a teacher, the teacher can give you very precise instructions that's just kind of tailor-made for you, which we would think, oh, that's best. You know, I'll find that teacher who'll tailor-make it for me, and I'll just, that'll be efficient and that'll be great. Watch out. A really important way that instructions work is by not working very well. Because, you know, we tend to be kind of so focused on doing it right sometimes, some of us, And there's a right way, and there's a right experience we're supposed to have, and we're chasing those right experiences. We're trying to figure out exactly the right technique that will make everything click, and we'll be happy ever after. And rather, what can happen is we start seeing, because it's not working quite the way we expected, because, you know, it's whatever reason, we start seeing all these strange attitudes we have about meditation, about life, that come into play as we're practicing. I remember when I first started meditating and went on retreat, before I went for my first retreat, I was just, I was kind of content, happy with myself, maybe a little bit proud, that I seemed to be able to get concentrated. And this is good, you know. And then I went on my first retreat, and I just couldn't get concentrated. And I got so frustrated and angry and despairing. It was like pretty ugly what happened to me. You know, I couldn't get concentrated, so I tried harder to concentrate. And because the more harder I tried, the worse it was. So the only thing I knew was to try harder. And it just got so ugly until I finally crashed and kind of bottomed out. And that's when the meditation began, when I gave up. And so there's all these attitudes we bring with us in life. Some people are perfectionists, some people feel like, you know, all kinds of things. And so it's a very important part of the path of practice is to discover all these attitudes we bring with us, all these ways we expect to succeed, we want to succeed, we're afraid of succeeding, we feel like we're inadequate, we feel like we can't do it, we feel disappointed, we feel like we've already failed before we sit down to meditate. There's a plethora of attitudes that people have which are not so healthy to have. And as we do this practice and are trying to do the instructions sincerely, we bump up into those things. And if we bump up to them like I did and feel like, well, I'm not getting concentrated I'm supposed to, and I try harder and harder, then it just makes a mess of things. But if you notice this is difficult, and then you notice, wait a minute, I'm attached to getting concentrated. I have a very particular idea. I think this, I'm convinced I know what's supposed to happen. And my certainty of what's supposed to happen is not happening. That's where there's a tension building up. So when meditation fails, when you don't succeed, it might be the best times. Because you might discover where you're attached and what your expectations are and what your view of yourself and what you're doing with that and how you relate to so-called failure. So don't be afraid of failing in meditation. I recommend some to do it sometimes. Don't do it intentionally, but you'll fail anyway. I think it's built into the whole scene. There's very few people sit down, meditate, close their eyes, you know, you know, they're just like done. You know, it's so great. It's it's really meditation has a lot to do with confronting yourself, meeting yourself, and all the different shenanigans that you have going on inside, and working through them, and ironing out the creases and the folds, and you know, all the challenges you have inside. And so, trying to do the instructions is necessary, but succeeding in the conventional way might not be. And part of the reason for this is two important things, like principles for the kind of meditation we're doing that's important. One is understanding, self-understanding, really deep self-understanding. And sooner or later, you'll discover that what you understand is your foibles, your attachments, your clinging, your fears, your resistance, you know, where you get tripped up. And more likely, it's sooner and later. And people can go along and practice, and then it clicks in, and people start getting concentrated, and it looks very nice and sweet, and get deeper, and then boom, run into some difficulty, some other aspect, some corner of the mind, some basement that's never been cleaned out before, you know, shows itself up, and then you have to deal with the basement. And one of the remarkable kind of phenomena that happens in the meditation world is oftentimes, not always, but often, is that meditation will open up into something really beautiful and sweet and wonderful, and some people even say some kind of realization. And then they're, wow, this is good. I'll never be unhappy ever again. And then a little bit later, you know, it opens up to some difficult time. Some real difficulty arises. It's almost like the good thing was a setup for the difficulty. It's almost like something opened and released so that something that's been held deeper down can finally appear. And so the meditation instructions sometimes are given in such a simple way that it seems like there should be never any problems. You know, you should just, you know, sit down and focus on your breath. And, you know, count your breath 1 to 10 and off you'll go, and or whatever the instructions are. And the other thing that the meditation instructions are for, and classically in Buddhism, is to teach us how to let go in a deep way. So which is another way of saying liberation. And conventional success in meditation might not be so helpful in letting go deeply. But sometimes we let go most deeply when we run into our challenges. And maybe some people have to let go of expecting to have good meditation. And maybe that's the way forward, is to let go and let go and let go of something. As people let go more deeply, it tends to be easier to meditate. And meditation tends to be easier. And so to do the instructions and understand part of the function of the instructions, or purposes of them, is to help us begin to see or to learn, where do we let go? What are the holding clingings we have? Where do we let go? And having that as a principle as we go along can be very helpful. So I had in mind of telling you in broad outlines the standard instructions. Some of you might know it already. But before I do that, sometimes it's helpful to have a little slogan. And you might have your own little slogan, but a little meditation instruction slogan that helps you to keep it really simple. Because sometimes the instructions can sound complicated. Zen people, when they hear Vipassana instructions, they can't believe it. You guys keep talking and talking and explaining. And just sit down and be present. So the Indian Vipassana teacher named Munindraji, he had a slogan. He said, if it's not simple, it's not Vipassana. If it's not simple, it's not Vipassana. And then when I was with him a little bit in Calcutta, I had my traveler's check stolen. Travel checks back then. Could you explain what those are? Back in the ancient times. And so they were stolen. And I saw him later in the day, and I said, my traveler's checks were stolen. And he said, Gil, it's important to be simple, but not a simpleton. Anyway, so Vipassana is—it's not simple. It's not Vipassana. So some of these little slogans. So one slogan that I like is "Be still and gaze upon everything kindly." Just be still and gaze upon everything kindly. Another one is, trust being aware of what is, not changing what is. Trust being aware of what's going on instead of trusting changing what's going on. And another one is, I had another one I wanted to tell you. Oh, yeah. Abide conscious, not self-conscious. So abide means to dwell in awareness, dwell in some way. Rest, be conscious, don't be self-conscious. And that's one of the ways we get tripped up in meditation, is that we confuse those two. And so rather than being aware, we're self-conscious in a kind of preoccupied, conceited, or self-concerned kind of way that can tie us in knots and make the whole meditation much more difficult. So the idea of don't be so self-concerned, self-referential, as you engage in the instructions and the practice and go deeper. So, to be simple. So the instructions, the standard instructions on the insight retreat, at least the way they used to be, and the way I'd like to teach it still at our insight retreat center, is on the first day to teach a mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing is an ancient practice that can be a complete practice in itself. You don't have to do anything other practices but mindfulness of breathing. The Buddha taught a whole series of steps just having to do with mindfulness of breathing. And I had a teacher in Japan who said, you can learn everything you need to know about Buddhism being mindful of your breathing. I think it gave it that much importance. But in the first day of the retreat, we do mindfulness breathing to keep things really simple. People often come with agitated minds, preoccupied minds, they're tired. And you don't want to do them a lot of complicated things to think about, be concerned with the instructions. You want to do something really simple that helps settle the mind, helps them relax, and helps them let go of their distracted thoughts and concerns. And mindfulness of breathing is one of the very, for most people, a very simple, basic way of doing that. It's also a way of building up concentration, stability, calmness, which is a very important support for the mindfulness practice itself. A lot of times, the first day of retreat, in some ways, I think, we just want to, we give people a little bit of instructions just to keep them entertained, or keep them kind of occupied. Because on the first day of retreat, a lot of the benefit doesn't come from the practice you do. It just comes from the fact that you're away from your life and you're not talking to anyone and it's silent and it's quiet and peaceful and your whole system begins to settle down and relax. And if we're too self-conscious, I know people, I've done this, you show up the first day, this is the retreat. And the first day, I'm going to bear down and strain. I'm going to do it, this retreat. And it just gets worse and worse. Just chill out, sit down. Just the first day, give yourself a break, especially people who have busy, active lives. It's just, don't try so hard. Just let the system calm you down. I like to teach people that at some point, we want the practice to practice us. It isn't that we do the practice. We allow the practice to do us. So then the second day, as people get settled in a little bit more, often what becomes more salient is that their bodies begin to show themselves more. Their body aches, the knees, the back, different things hurt a little bit. But as people settle in, they also tend to become more aware of their body in nice ways as well. The fact that we're embodied beings becomes a little bit more accessible. And so the instructions on the second day tend to be instructions of how to be mindful of the body, how to be attentive to what's going on physically, including the breath. And one of the advantages of this in the second day is that our physical embodied experience is not a story. And again, in the beginning of retreat, people are so easily pulled into their stories about their life and what's going on and what happened and what will happen and their plans. And if they have experienced some difficulty in their body, they make a story out of it. And then they're caught up in the story of everything. And so the teachings are meant to be very simple. Just sense and feel the body. Sit, be still, and gaze kindly on the experience of your body. And then the third day, then we do mindfulness of emotions. Mindfulness of emotions is a lot easier to do if you know how to be present for your body. If you don't know how to be embodied as you're having emotions, it's much more difficult to experience definitely strong emotions. But if you can really let the body be the container, the field in which they occur and you're aware of, it's a lot easier to get settled and a lot easier for the emotions to do what they need to do, to process and unfold. And then the fourth day, the instructions have to do with mindfulness of thinking. If we did mindfulness of thinking the first day, people would just think more. But by the fourth day, they're ready to they're still hopefully calm enough or stable enough that they can actually turn awareness to look at thinking and not get caught up in the thoughts. And doing that, find some freedom in relationship to thinking. Those four steps are kind of the basic instructions. To go along with that, sometimes, and what I like to teach, is always go back to your breathing. Breathing is kind of at the center. and only leave the breathing to go to the other, to the body, emotions, or thoughts, if those things become much more predominant, compelling, they pull the attention, then we go pay attention to that, and then we go back to the breathing. Now, with those basic standard instructions, there can be, the teachers can have all kinds of different emphases. They can use that to teach different things or to give kind of more different kinds of instructions. Some teachers might say, with this basic instructions, really start being a little more clear and precise to recognize what's happening in the moment. So they're recognizing the feelings, the sensations, the thoughts. Another teacher might say, as you're settling into this, doing this practice, notice more how you're aware. Notice if you're trying a lot or straining in the awareness itself, or if you're complacent and too lackadaisical. Can you find a way to keep a relaxed, open, but somehow a determined attention at the same time? And so they're focusing more on the nature of awareness than the nature of what you're aware of. Like, you know, deep, you know, penetrating sensing of the breathing is one way, and the opposite way is clear awareness of how we're with the breathing. Some teachers might focus more on developing concentration. Some people more on open awareness and mindfulness. Some teachers, there's all kinds of variations that people can do. And so the different teachers you hear will give different emphases and take this, you know, central teaching and expand it or adjust a little bit. And that's part of the richness of it. And so you can practice with different teachers, and they might have very similar basic instructions, but how it's applied varies. And so you get a chance to learn different things and find other things out. In the end, I think that, in the beginning, it's not so much that you're supposed to learn a technique, but you're supposed to learn how to navigate your own mind, your own experience. You're becoming your own teacher for yourself. And you're learning what works and what doesn't work from you. You're learning what the tendencies of your mind are. You're learning the landscape. You're learning the tools, mental tools you have, so that you can navigate all the different comings and goings of your mind and your heart and find a way to be free in the middle of it, at peace with it, not being in conflict with it, how to learn from it, how to transform it, how to be wise about it all. And there's no, you know, there's no like roadmap for that. There's not like a one, you know, just get on the freeway and just go north or something. It's all about learning about yourself and knowing how to navigate the ins and outs of your own mind and heart and how to meet it and how to make your own adjustments as you go along. And I'm aware that as I say this, it might sound complicated. It's only complicated if you hear it all at once, which is how I was taught, how some of us were taught in Burma. We went to the center in Burma where this practice got started. And we arrived the first day, and they gave us a cassette tape and a cassette player. And we went to our room, and the entire instructions for the whole retreat were given to us on this cassette tape, and it took 15 minutes. And then we just went to do it. And so we found here, the reason I gave you the standard here, where you do these slowly over time, is that it's a lot easier to absorb it if it's in pieces. And it's a lot easier to kind of get centered and focused on the inner life if you kind of go through it kind of in layers rather than try to do the whole buzzing confusion of all at once. Generally, that's the case. Over time, we learn all these different things. We learn a lot about ourselves. And maybe after 10 years of practice, if you were going to explain to some novice beginner all the things you've learned, they might think, wow, that's complicated. But, you know, it's... You know, I don't know analogy with this to use for this. Have you watched a 16-year-old use a smartphone? it's easy. It's a breeze. Like, you know, you can do it in your sleep, you know. It's like, isn't it easy? But, you know, and maybe for some of you it's easy, you've done it long enough, but I've known people, even now, older people, who, one person I heard about recently who was in his 70s, just couldn't figure out how to use it. You know, it was just way beyond his ability at that point. So we can do all kinds of complicated things and make it second nature and easy for us to do. And so it's the same with meditation. As we do it, we consciously and unconsciously, intentionally and unintentionally, learn the terrain, learn how to navigate, learn to find our way. But in order to do that, there's something that's required. If you want to benefit from meditation, if you want to learn from it, if you want to be transformed by it and grow and develop and find the freedom that it has to offer, there's an essential requirement. There's no way around it. You got to do it. You got to do it. And it's a fantastic thing to do it day in and day out, to make it just as normal part of your day as brushing your teeth. And the incremental changes that happen slowly over time maybe are the ones that are most lasting and most profound. Some people who do meditation are looking for the big bang experiences, then they'll be happy ever after, that's it, and then they'll be special because they had the big bang enlightenment or something. I think that some of the most significant and inspiring transformations I've seen in people have been the changes that have been slow by just doing it day after day for a long, long time. So I'll give you, hopefully inspire you about the slow, everyday changes, how they, you know, that you don't see day by day, but how over time they can be huge. As the example, many years ago I had a yoga teacher who was teaching us how to go into the triangle pose, which is with one hand reaching for the sky and one hand touching the floor, balanced on the floor, and kind of bent over like a 90 degrees or something with the torso. And some people, their hamstrings are too tight or something, they can't get their one hand down on the floor. So the instructions were, because this is back, you know, in those primitive times, was to get a stack of telephone books, you know, however many you needed, and put them on the floor, and lean over and put that hand down on and rest on the top of the telephone book, so elevated from the floor, so you get into the triangle pose that way, and then every day you rip out one page, and the telephone page books. They used to be really thin. So tearing out one page doesn't do much. But you do it every day. And after 100 days, it's something. After a year, it's much more. And eventually, everyone can get their hands down on the floor. So it's kind of like that. Everyday practice. You'll change in all kinds of ways if you practice sincerely. And it might be incremental. Don't think it's not working. It's just the changes are telephone paper thin. Sometimes. And sometimes they're more dramatic. So the meditation instructions are treasures that become valuable in how we engage in them and practice with them. And if you practice with them, in the early periods of time and as beginners, it doesn't really matter if you have the right instructions for you, because a lot of the learning is not about getting anything from the instructions except just learning about your foibles and learning how to settle in and relax and be present. And then over time, you'll find what's the best instruction for you and your own way forward. And I hope that if you take the meditation path, the mindfulness path, as far as it goes, you come to have a profound love and appreciation for yourself, for your capacity for freedom and compassion, and for your ability to be present in this world with a heart that is not in conflict with anything. May you have a conflict-free heart. Thank you.